fighting out of Toronto, Canada, he is the bodybuilding champion of the world, presenting James Hurricane Hurgot.
James Hurgot here with the Hurgot Show, and I am joined by Jordan B. Peterson, who is a professor of psychology at University of Toronto. And he also worked as a professor at Harvard and has had a clinical practice as well. And pretty experienced in terms of personalities and, you know, a lot of different things. I've essentially taken his Maps of Meaning course by watching it online, which I recommend to anybody. There are certain things, Jordan, actually within that, within watching that, that really kind of changed my mind about a lot of things. And I was pretty impressed with the types of things that you covered within that course. And I know that for somebody to watch something online, it's kind of a heavy thing to watch lectures. But I found you to be somebody who's very enjoyable to watch and who's able to take very complex concepts and explain them well. So first of all, welcome to the show, and also thank you for posting this kind of content online and, you know, at least being able to reach people like myself who maybe aren't in school but can benefit from some of the knowledge that you put out there.
Yeah, well, that's one of the great things about YouTube and online videos, that makes university content available to anyone who's interested in learning, and that's a great thing. So I'm very happy that the courses were useful to you and to anyone else who was interested in watching them.
Yes, and you also have a self-authoring program, which I want to get into more in depth, which I think would really benefit a lot of people. I come from a fitness background, entertainment background, and I see a lot of people in our society in today's day and age who, you know, they'll spend a lot of time maybe going to the gym, working out. They'll, get their social media just right, you know, picking the right filters for their Instagram and all this sort of thing. And even being in the dating world, I can tell you, people invest a lot of time in that sort of thing kind of to attract people. But I found that a lot of the people that I have at least interacted with don't seem to spend very much time working on their inner growth or their personalities. Do you think that that's something that's kind of a recent phenomenon, and that maybe we are lacking as human beings on working on that inner development?
Well, you know, one of the things that was the case when people used to go to church every week was at least they spent an hour a week thinking about personal development and about proper behavior and say what you might about organized religions. People are often very critical of them, but it seems reasonable to spend at least some time thinking about how you should be living your life. And our society now is very appearance-oriented, and I think social media plays that up more, perhaps more than at any other time in history, because your artificial image is in some sense as real as your real, as the reality of you. At least that's how people act. And we built the self-authoring program to help people develop their character and to clear up trouble they might be having with their personalities and with their past. So the program has four components. One component helps people write an autobiography. That's the past authoring program. There's a present authoring sequence that helps you identify your virtues and your faults. Your virtues so that you can work on developing them, and your faults so that you can work on overcoming them. And then the last program, which is the future authoring program, helps people write out a detailed plan for what they'd like their lives to be 3 to 5 years into the future. And I developed this about, or my team developed this about 10 years ago, maybe a little longer than that, because I noticed that at university, I was teaching students who were maybe 21 or 22 years old just prior to graduating, and I noticed that no one had ever sat them down and got them to write rigorously about what sort of character they wanted to build and what sort of future they wanted to have. And that struck me as a terrible oversight. The program asks you, well, the past authoring program asks you to divide your life into six sections. And you can divide it any way you want. And then to identify the emotionally significant events in each of those sections. And there's kind of a rule of thumb that if you have an emotion that's more than about 18 months old, especially a negative emotion, something that you remember with sorrow or anxiety or disgust or maybe even a traumatic memory, that means that you haven't fully processed it. You haven't done a causal analysis of the event to understand how your behavior and the situation contributed to its occurrence in a way that would help you avoid similar things in the future. And if you have memories like that, they're like holes in your map of the world. And your mind, your psyche doesn't like holes in your map of the world because it assumes that you could fall through them again. And so it elevates your production of stress hormones like cortisol, because the more damaged your map of the world is, the more dangerous your mind presumes the world is. And so it's always preparing you for an emergency. And that's very stressful for people. And so there's a psychologist named James Pennebaker who worked at the University of Texas at Austin. And he's demonstrated that if people write about their past, they write about anything that reduces uncertainty, that they get healthier and their immune system works better and they're less anxious and depressed. And so the past authoring program is a program that's designed to help you make peace with the trouble of your past. And then the present authoring program helps you do an assessment of your personality using modern personality models and to identify where your strengths are and to figure out how you might capitalize on those, and also to identify your weaknesses so that you can figure out how to overcome those. And then the future authoring program, which we've done the most research on, the future authoring program, we've tested it with several thousand university students, mostly in Europe, but also in Canada. And we showed that we can decrease their dropout rate by about 25% and increase their grade point average by about 20%. The program really seems to help people with commitment and also with control of uncertainty and also with positive emotion. So it asks you six questions, first of all. It asks you to put yourself in the state of mind where you were taking care of yourself, like you were taking care of someone that you actually cared about. And then to think about how your life could be 3 to 5 years down the road if you had what would make your life full and significant. And then it asks you to think about your educational plans and your career and your family and your intimate relationships and how you handle drugs and alcohol and how you would take care of your mental and physical health, among other things. And then it gets you to write for 15 minutes without too much concern for grammar or spelling about just exactly what your life could be like if it turned out the way that would be best for you. And then it asks you to do the reverse, to imagine that you let your weaknesses and resentments and faults take control of you and auger you into the ground so that things turned out very badly for you. And so that helps people identify a little heaven to strive for and a little hell to avoid. And that's very useful because if you know why you're doing something, both to get away from something terrible and to move towards something good, then you're much more motivated to do it. You're much more likely to stick to it. And the second half of that program helps people articulate a detailed plan to attain their positive vision. And it seems to be very effective for people. We've been very gratified by the results. And thousands of people have tried it now.
Yeah, I think this is a great thing and underappreciated. You know, I can only kind of speak of my, interaction with the world and today's culture and sort of what I see. And one of the things I've seen, like, especially being on the, in the dating scene, you know, at the age of 40, is it seems that a lot of people, we live in a very disposable time. So in other words, like, you go out with somebody and you run into like a rough patch where, like, you know, you have a fight or something like that, the disagreement over something that would probably be something that, you know, you can just really talk about. But in today's day and age, people will say, well, this, you're not the one for me, this isn't working out. And then they'll jump out of that relationship and jump into the new, you know, the next one. And there's all these, you know, dating apps and things like that. So people can literally just sort of like go from one to the other and sort of operate on a surface level and never really have like actual deep intimacy with people. And I found that personally to be a problem, that just, you know, that access to, you know, because let's face it, like 100 years ago or whatever period of time, you'd be limited to, you know, the people within your community and different things. And, you know, there wouldn't be so much stimulation. So people would kind of be forced to work on actually working on their relationships. And, you know, they would see examples of other people that are working on those relationships. And in my experience, I've seen that people, they just look at it like it's the other person that's the problem. So as soon as they run into a situation, they jump to the next person. But my mom has an expression, or, you know, uses the expression, wherever you go, you take yourself with you. And it seems to me that people will hop from these relationships and they're still the same person. And they've never done an autopsy on like why that relationship fell apart in terms of themselves. So I wanted to know what your thoughts were in terms of people in today's day and age and not really investing in themselves and kind of the ramifications of that.
Yeah, well, I think that helps generate an anxiety-ridden and meaningless life, because there's no continuing story for the medium to the long term. I think in our culture, increasingly, we act like we're 18 forever. And we don't understand that over the course of your life, you have to build something in order to remain satisfied with your existence. And part of that is building an intimate relationship with someone, partly because it's healthier to do that. Two brains are better than one. And interacting deeply with someone that you can't run away from, because that forces you to contend with them, that builds your character and builds their character too. And of course, that also provides the foundation for a family. And as you get older, your family becomes increasingly important to anchor you in life. I mean, by the time you're in your 50s, if you have children, as a general rule, they're the most important thing in your life. You know, they're starting to grow up at that point, but that seems to be the part of life that's genuine and real. And I think our culture acts very immaturely, because we do increasingly act as if people are disposable. I mean, the psychologist Carl Jung talked about the necessity for marriage as a psychological, from a psychological perspective. And he said, if you don't tie yourself to someone, then so that you can't run away, there's no reason for you to reveal yourself to them, and there's no reason to really solve the problems, because as you pointed out, you can just jump to another person. And so then whenever the going gets rough, you don't have to make any changes. You don't have to think. You can just assume that there's a better person waiting for you out there somewhere. And the problem is that a great relationship, I mean, hopefully a relationship starts with a certain amount of honesty and willingness to communicate and some attraction, but a great relationship is built over time. It's not something that you discover and live happily ever after. It's a very shallow way of looking at it. And I do think that your best bet for finding a great relationship is to work on your own personal development and try to build yourself into the kind of character that could have a great relationship. And that would be someone who can speak honestly and who can listen and who's reciprocal in their interactions and is willing to solve problems and to commit over the long run. It's that sort of thing that transforms the potential of your life into accomplishment and hopefully gives you the necessary sense of satisfaction and meaning that helps buttress you against life's finitude and suffering. There's almost nothing better than character development. And then you take that with you wherever you go. And a lot of that has to do with sorting out your priorities and deciding what you're aiming at. And aiming at having a good character is the highest aim. And it's the aim that will provide the most meaning in your life.
Well, I have a 2.5-year-old daughter, and I'm very concerned about like the future of our society. You know, we have, for the first time, more people born into single, relationships than married relationships. And, you see this in the poorer communities even more so. And there's no real kind of push in our society for a family structure. And, I think from a cultural point of view, like I know, from following your Maps of Meaning, you look at the Disney films of the past and mythology and things like that. And I have to think that some of the current Disney movies and shows like The Bachelor and all these types of things create a very like kind of idealized version of what people should expect. And, I'm sure pornography for men would have the same effect as something like The Bachelor might have on women. But, and I found the people's expectations are kind of crazy. Like they expect that they're going to meet this perfect person. And the way that you articulated it is perfect. Like I've always seen a relationship as like a tree where it's like you're going to have, the wind blows it, but that's part of the character of what builds it. And I've seen a lot of people that kind of look at it like, oh, you're perfect for me. And then as soon as like there's a gust of wind, it's like, oh, this isn't the right relationship. Not really understanding that those challenges and working through that is an opportunity to actually build real intimacy. And I'm very concerned that in our day and age that the media just kind of makes it like some Prince Charming for women is going to come into your life and be perfect and everything you ever wanted and save you from stuff. And I've seen a lot of women, again, my age, who have not found anybody. And it's my personal speculation that they've expected that they're going to meet this perfect Prince Charming. And then when that didn't happen, they kept going from relationship to relationship. And then they got to an age where now, the opportunity to have children and stuff, might be an issue. I even know women who very successful in their personal life, in their business life. They have great careers. They're very attractive. They can't seem to find a suitable mate. And then I hear them talk about like they're going to do in vitro fertilization or something like this. And to me, you're more of an expert on this than I ever have been. But to me, it seems like you're missing a step there, that you're kind of running before you crawl, and that maybe you should be able to have a relationship with somebody that wants to be there before you jump into becoming a parent. What would this type of environment produce in terms of the next generation and kind of the breakdown of the family overall?
Well, I mean, the evidence suggests that, although it's increasingly difficult to talk about this because people get offended, but the evidence strongly suggests that children in intact families do much better than children from single-parent families. And part of the reason for that is that it's not like single parents don't strive to do well for their children, but raising children is a very difficult job. It's very stressful and intense, and it's a two-person job to run a household and a family. I think women in our society have very difficult choices to make because it takes you often into until you're into your 30s to establish a career and to make yourself somewhat financially independent. And of course, that's exactly the time when you're faced with the necessity of having children, if you're going to have them, and then balancing the requirement to work with the obligations of having a family is, of course, very, very difficult. And so I think a lot of women find themselves in the trap that you described, is that they've been concentrating on building their career and their financial life, and then they try to rush the child and relationship part of it in their mid to late 30s, and it's pretty desperate. They get pretty desperate, and unsurprisingly, it's also the case that in our society now, marriage has become a luxury that's reserved for the rich. And I just can't see that as a good thing, because I believe that children need a model for both sexes, as well as the stability that having two parents provides. I mean, just to spell each other off is so important, and to support each other when you have children, it's much better for the children. And I think two people tend to be more reasonable than one person as well, because if one person is upset or stressed or hungover or desperate, the other person can step in to mediate and to calm them down and to keep an eye on them. And it's just a much more stable, it's much more stable relationship. I mean, we used to have extended families, and of course they have their pros and their cons. And then, you know, that was reduced to the nuclear family, and now we seem hell-bent to fragment that as well. And I believe that it's producing people who are very isolated and oriented towards the short term and distrustful of other people, because all they've encountered are relationships that fragment and don't work. So I think it's very dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, I'm personally very concerned about the future, and I don't mind being a little politically correct, or sorry, incorrect, because to me, it's more important to speak about the truth as you see it than it is. Like, it seems to me almost like in our culture, people, and you know, you face this with some of the things that you've been doing in terms of like the transgender pronouns and stuff, but you know, it seems to me like people are more worried about hurting other people's feelings than they are with actually looking at the problem. And the way I look at it is like, is it worse to tell somebody that they have cancer, or is it, you know, isn't it better to actually deal with the fact that the person has cancer and now we can, you know, look at the treatment? And the statistics out there on like fatherlessness are astounding. I mean, I don't have them in front of me, but it's something like, you know, the children who are likely to commit suicide or to end up in correctional facilities or, you know, to be promiscuous. I mean, we're talking like 60 to 80% in most of the categories are from, you know, fatherless homes. And you see this in certain minority communities in the U.S. and different things like that. And it's kind of spreading into all kinds of demographics. And one thing that I think goes contrary to sort of the Darwin theory of things is you have a welfare state now. So even though you're saying about that it's a luxury at this point in time to get married, what isn't a luxury is that, well, I'll give you an example. I know a couple who have their own business, from what I can see, a very loving couple, and they have two beautiful children, and they want to have more kids, but they pay a bunch in taxes, and they can't afford to have more children. And then I've seen women who are in assisted housing, basically living on welfare and living on child support, and they have multiple fathers and they'll have like four kids. So you have a situation where you have a demographic where people are having more children and they're, let's say, from the poor end of our culture, maybe the lower IQ of our culture, and, you know, maybe even worse, more the less impulse control aspect of our society. And with the welfare system, they'll come in and help those people. So essentially there's no consequences. Whereas maybe 100 years ago, some, you know, again, getting back to what you said about the church or, even the community, somebody might have said like, hey, you can't afford to have four children. Nobody's saying that. Now they're saying like, you go girl, like we'll come in, we'll support you, and essentially taking money from contributing members of society and giving it to people who are living off a system. And there's got to be some consequences to this, because instead of it being essentially, you're kind of having a dysgenics effect, so to speak, because you're sort of, for lack of a better term, the poor and less sophisticated people in society are having more children, and from broken homes, which leads to sociopathic behavior and all these other things. And I'm very concerned, and I don't mind being politically incorrect about this, because I think that the underpinnings of our society in many ways are being pulled out, and I'm afraid of what the future generations are going to look like if we don't speak out and we don't address these things. So I wondered if you had any thoughts on that kind of phenomenon.
Well, you know, what I would say is that I'd encourage your listeners, the men among your listeners and the women, to try to do things in a more traditional way, to find a partner and make it permanent, even though that requires a lot of stress and strife, and to raise a family that has two parents. That's an ideal that's worth attaining and or worth striving for. And it's also something that can give your life some significance and give your children the most stable possible environment. I think that our society has ceased to value things, and we don't give people credit for shouldering responsibility and acting in a manner that's going to benefit their children and society. No, it's become increasingly old-fashioned to insist that a proper family has a father and a mother. And I think that's a great catastrophe, because it, as far as I'm concerned, it's only going to lead to an increasingly chaotic situation. I know Kathleen Wynne's government has just introduced a new family bill that radically redefines what constitutes the family, and I'm sure she believes that that constitutes social progress, but I think all it'll do is confuse people even more. And the problem with having poorly defined roles is that it doesn't so much give people freedom to do what they want as it removes any rules from the game and leaves them with nothing. And life is, I think, too hard to go through alone. And I mean, if you tie yourself up with someone else, of course, then you're stuck with them. But the wisdom of the human race suggests that it's a better medium to long-term solution to build a tight family around you, so that at least you have something instead of nothing. And that requires adoption of responsibility. You talked about pornography and Tinder and those sorts of things that offer people sort of short-term impulsive solutions. And I suppose they work fine for the short-term impulsive future, but as medium to long-term solutions, they're very shallow. And I think people know this. I know that there are many men online who have decided to stop using pornography altogether. And it seems to me that that's for the best. It's a ruinous force, I think. And we've fallen into it tremendously. And it's all part of this movement towards what I would call short-term gratification and the destabilization. It's the destabilization of the substructure of our society. It's as if we've forgotten that it's worth preserving and protecting.
Right. And, you know, as hard as it is maybe to work through a relationship and, you know, have kind of a long-term partnership, my understanding of what the studies show is that, like, let's say, and I know you work in clinical psychology, but that, like, if a couple, and let's say they're healthy for all intents and purposes, they run into a hard time. If they work through that, you know, years later, then they're going to, you know, be happier that they did work through that. And I think that people, they underestimate the benefits of a true intimate relationship where, you know, you really get to know the other person. And then the alternative benefit of that is children and younger people who are coming up, they can see that, you know, the generations that come before them, they have, you know, a strong positive relationship, and they can see how those people navigate the waters and work through issues together and things like that. And if you don't have that in your life, you're not setting a good example for children, because they don't have anything to look at where they can see, oh, this is what a real couple is like. And
well, and they lose their grandparents and they lose their cousins, and you know, I don't think that it's very much fun to go through life alone. It's very isolated and cold. And another thing that we really haven't considered is, what are people going to do when they're old? Because I can't imagine a fate in some sense that's worse than being old and completely isolated. And, you know, your friends fall away as you get older, not always, but family bonds are the ones that generally really last. And if you haven't established a credible relationship in your life and sort of populated your life with children, then it's beyond me what's going to sustain you when you get old. I don't think golf will do it.
Yeah, and I want to speak on this because, well, I see it in terms of men, in terms of them, you know, kind of the Peter Pan syndrome where people are, and frankly, I a lot of the men I know who are my age, they're afraid of marriage because of what's happened in the family court system and what they've seen happen to their parent, their fathers, and things like that. So there's been this like MGTOW kind of movement where men are like, you know, I don't want to get married, I don't want to have kids, I'm going to get, you know, taken to the cleaners if I do this. And whenever you have something, there's always unintended consequences of that. So it might be, you know, and of course these things came from legitimate concerns on the other end of, like, there was women that were, you know, came out of relationships and had nothing, and they were, you know, primarily the caregivers in the home and stuff. But there comes to a point where things go swing the balance the other way. And what I've seen swing the balance the other way is now that the family court system is in such a way that kind of the word is out amongst men, like, you shouldn't get married, there's no benefits, at least, you know, what from what they can see of having kids, because if the marriage breaks down, the woman's going to get the kids, and then you're just going to have to pay for it and all this stuff. And it might sound like, oh, it's great to punish these men, but what you're doing is you're setting up a situation where men are checking out. You know, there's a great book called Men on Strike that kind of addresses this, where men are just sort of opting out. And then the other side of that is, I see a lot of women who have been empowered by kind of the Oprah movement of, you can do everything on your own and stuff like this, you can have a career, you can have children. And just from somebody who's dated people in their 30s and 40s who are women, a lot of them kind of have this, I've dated single mothers, and it's almost like they make the child the relationship, because the child has no, as you know, has no choice about being there. Whereas like a mate, you know, can say, well, you're not somebody who's very likable or is making this easy for me, so I'm going to leave. A child has no choice. And I see this kind of Oedipus situation where I've literally dated mothers where the child is playing video games and the mother is bringing them, you know, food and drink right to their bedroom door, giving the child whatever it wants, kind of coddling it, and all this stuff, like right up to the teens. And it seems to me like those children are going to, well, within the fitness community, if you don't work a muscle, it atrophies. And if you don't allow children to develop and become their own people, they're not going to be very equipped for society. So the children are losing in terms of not becoming full people. These parents who are doing this, they're losing because they're not really having a healthy relationship with somebody who wants to be there. And then the other side, which you really articulated well, is that people aren't thinking, like, okay, let's say you're an attractive woman who's 30, 40. You can attract men and you can lock them into a situation. I don't mean lock in terms of like slavery, but I mean, you can get somebody who's going to get into a relationship with you. But if you don't do that at that time and you let time slip by, those children will eventually grow up and move out. Your parents will eventually pass away. And what happens our lifespan's extending. So what happens after those kids move out and those parents don't have a relationship that they've founded, and they're going to spend the next half of their life without a mate? And then imagine trying to find somebody in your 50s, 60s, 70s to date. And, you know, men die younger than women, so you have that issue. And then what happens to these children who were coddled and basically the relationship in that situation and never really learned to have a healthy structure? I know that's a lot to unpack, but I kind of see it as a holistic problem.
Yeah, well, I don't know how many men are in the men going their own way movement. I've encountered it online a fair bit, and I know that people's fears of the family courts can be well-founded. I mean, it seems to me that the family courts are tilted very badly in a punitive direction with regards to men, and I do think it's had the consequence that you describe. I mean, obviously, it's necessary for men to take responsibility for children that they have fathered, but many men do seem to end up with the worst of both worlds. They have a tremendous financial burden, and they have almost no access to their children, and then their children are often turned against them in one way or another by vindictive mothers. That doesn't always happen, obviously, but it happens fairly regularly.
And I'm gonna interrupt you here, because I just want to tell you a personal story, my experience, because I've been in family court, and I saw, you know, what was portrayed in the media, and I thought it was bad. But I can tell you personally, just, I don't want to get too much into my personal situation, but I can tell you, as a father of a 2.5-year-old girl, here's how it kind of went for me. I had to, and I've never had a criminal record. I've never been accused of abusing. I've been a professional my entire life. I've been cleared by the Pentagon because I had to go to Iraq as part of a thing to help the troops there that, you know, was from an entertainment point of view. So I have a completely clean record. You know, my mother's been a teacher for 50 years. My father was an airline captain for 30 years. And the way that initially things were when I was taken to court is I had to have supervised visitations during the daytime for the first 4 months with my daughter, while my ex got full custody and full parenting rights during that time. And the only explanation that I could see was that I was a man. Like, there was no difference in terms of any kind of allegations. That seemed to be the default. And apparently, I interviewed a respected attorney who has been heading up a bill to make it a default that there's shared parenting and joint custody, so that is the way that it is in our society. And it was fought by the Bar Association, because obviously the Bar Association doesn't want it to be that cut and dry that, oh, if you break up in a marriage, the kids go 50-50 and, you know, it's that simple. So right now the default is, from what I've seen and what I've seen from other men, is basically the women automatically get custody of the children. You have to pay. And in my case, and many others, you can't even see your child without supervision and all this other craziness. So to me, that kind of spelt a warning sign of, like, I'm in this society and I've never done anything wrong, and now I have to be supervised to see my own daughter in order to even get the right to have overnights, which took several months. So I looked at it as pretty crazy, kind of like some of the things you're seeing in university. So sorry.
Yeah,
to...
Well, I've had clients who've been really ruined by the custody process. Men who wanted to have their children, you know, 50% of the time, who were just, whose lives were basically destroyed by their attempts to to reach that sort of agreement. So, yeah, and I mean, who knows what the long-term consequences are, but I have no figures on the men going their own way movement. I have no idea how popular that is, but it's certainly something that you can see popping up everywhere on the net. And it is definitely fueled by men's fear that they'll get tangled into a relationship and lose the relationship, but maintain all the financial commitments that are part and parcel of it. And that really is the worst of both worlds.
Well, and it's just common sense. I mean, psychology, if let's say you're on the boat, you know, in Normandy, and you're at the back of the boat and you see the first group of people go out onto the shore and they're mowed down and you're about to get off the boat, what are the chances that you want to step forward? And if you just see a trail of bodies, I mean, my father went through a divorce. I mean, if all the men around you have entered the system and been mowed down, so to speak, you know, there has to be incentives for people, you know, and yeah. It used to be that marriage was grounded within a religious unit and, you know, a cultural unit. And when that was all stripped away, it's just basically kind of a contract, and not a very good contract, especially for men from what I can see. And then there's unintended consequences, because if people aren't incentivized, I mean, you've done all these, or you're aware of all these research on rats and stuff like that. I mean, if there's nothing positive provided and only negative, it's just going to be the result that people are going to opt out in that kind of way. And I think it's kind of a horrific and short-term sighted thing to think, oh, well, we'll punish these men or we'll make it this way. But you're really messing with, like, the natural outcome of things as well.
Yeah, well, we've ceased wanting to do things like support the traditional family structure. And so there aren't policies in place that help that. So I know the conservatives several years ago were going to try to allow for income splitting within families, so that essentially the higher earning person of the couple, who's often the man, could split his income with his wife if she was staying home and raising children, for example, or if she was working part time. But the liberals put the kibosh on that, describing it as just a subsidy program for people who were more well off. And they seemed to have no interest whatsoever in supporting traditional family structures, and that's part of a misguided drive towards equality, where every family structure is accorded the same respect as every other one, even though I think that that's very, very misguided. I think it entices people down a very troublesome road. It's very hard to be a single parent. It isn't something that should be aimed at, because the responsibility is overwhelming. I mean, a child or two young children essentially constitute a full-time job. And to try to do that and to have a full-time job means that you have no life outside of your work and your children. And it's very burdensome and stressful. And I can't see it working as an ideal. Now, we haven't figured out exactly how to reconcile women taking an active role in the workplace with women as mothers. It's a very difficult thing to sort out, but it seems to me that deciding that every family is the same in terms of desirability is not an appropriate solution.
Right, and you know, you speak of this in your Maps and Meaning, and I wanted to get your thoughts on this. You know, you talk about, like, how close we are to primates and things like this in terms of kind of our social interactions. And, you know, you speak of women wanting to be with a higher status men. So now you have, because of the push of the government and everything else for women to do better. And, you know, I agree with the initial phases of feminism, but there comes to a point where things get kind of crazy. And at this point in time, there's more women graduating university than men. You know, and there's a lot of men who are, you know, getting more into video games and kind of, like, there seems to be you know, a lot of gender reversal. And I have to wonder what happens when the innate characteristic of women is they want to either date, you know, somebody equal to them in a social status or higher. And all of a sudden, if there's more women graduating university and getting careers and less men, that's really going to limit the pool of people that are within their social, you know, status and above. And I wonder what you thought the effects of that's going to be.
Well, I think what will happen is there'll be increased competition among women for the few men who have high status, and those high status men will have so many opportunities with women that their necessity to commit to any long-term relationship will be markedly attenuated. And then the men who are less successful, they'll have to content themselves with pornography or other distractions. That's how it looks to me. And I think there's some data on this at the colleges where there are more women than men. You'd think that all the men would have a lot of opportunities, but that doesn't seem to be what happens. What seems to happen is that the ever-shrinking number of relatively high-status male students have tremendous sexual opportunities on campuses like that, and the more ordinary men still have very few. So I think it'll be a matter of women increasingly chasing something that's in short supply. And I guess the other consequence of that will be that there'll be more and more push for government support for childcare and for non-standard familial arrangements. And I think we're already seeing that. You know, women will try to turn to arrangements other than those with a man in order to provide a secure base for their children. But generally speaking, radical social experiments fail. And so I don't see switching the structure of the family to something radically different. That'll produce all sorts of the unintended consequences that you already described.
Yeah, and one thing I'm really worried about is, you know, young men full of testosterone, and if they can't find a suitable mate, you know, I wonder in terms of kind of, well, you speak in your lectures about when there's an income disparity and what that creates in terms of violence and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I have kind of my own theory about this, but I have to imagine, let's say you're a Muslim man in society and you're kind of low in the spectrum of there's not a lot of women that would be attracted to you, or you're in a poor environment and you're not a high status male. These men don't have much to lose, and you know, you talk about the Cain and Abel, the, you know, from mythology and what mythologies teach us and what we should learn. And there's not only like economic disparity, but this disparity of people who are going to be attractive to women and those that aren't. And you know, I wonder if that isn't some of the reason for the radicalization of people, whether it's joining.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, there's lots of evidence on that. Well, like you said, low status men have very little to lose. And so they're often attracted to any endeavor that will offer them the opportunity to increase their status. I mean, there was a very interesting sociological analysis of drug sales gangs in the U.S. a while back. A student at a university, I think it was at the University of Chicago, happened to make contact with a drug dealing gang and infiltrated it. They knew who he was, but he got to be quite friendly with all the members of the gang, including the leader. And the gang disbanded because the housing project that they were centered in was torn down. And when the gang disbanded, the leader turned the books over to the student investigator, and what they found was that the typical street drug dealer was making less than minimum wage, but the reason that they were doing it was because there was some chance of moving up the hierarchy, you know, because it's a pretty violent game, and of course the leadership is changing all the time because people get killed, And so they kind of regarded it as a lottery ticket. You had to put in your time at the bottom, but there was some chance that you'd end up being one of the big guys, and that was worth it. You know, they also found that most of the drug dealers also had other jobs, so they tended to be more industrious than the typical person, perhaps. But yeah, the drive for status and achievement in men is very strong. And if it isn't given an outlet, then it looks for one. Certainly, radicalization is one option under those circumstances. It's a call to adventure. I mean, I think that's why groups like ISIS are able to attract support from all over the world, is that they offer disenfranchised young men the opportunity to go do something that looks heroic. It's an adventure. I mean, it's obviously a misguided adventure and a misbegotten notion, but if there's no valid form of status striving provided in your society, then you're going to do whatever's necessary to find it somewhere else.
Yeah, and you've got these mass school shootings and all these things, and it always seems that these people are, you know, kind of outcasts and things within society. And, you know, I have to wonder if that isn't, you know, again, they don't have much to lose, so maybe they want to make a name for themselves. Or
yeah,
whatever.
Sure, that's exactly what's happening. They pick infamy over non-entity. You know, they'd rather be famous for being terrible than not to be noticed at all. And a lot of that's driven by horrible resentment, you know, years of resentment and fantasizing about the fame that will go along with an act like that.
It's pretty scary. And, you know, a lot of people within the traditional media were really surprised about, you know, Trump getting in and stuff like that. And it was interesting when I was watching your lectures on Maps of Meaning, you were talking about the Egyptian mythology and kind of the constant pull between chaos and order. And I wondered if there wasn't a human instinct that maybe there's too much chaos going on, and that, you know, maybe the election of Trump and this thing, you know, with Brexit in the UK and some of these other things aren't somehow an inherent thing in us, where we maybe have felt that there is too much chaos and that something's not right, and therefore, you know, we have to pull in another direction. And, you know, you articulate this mythology of the pull for order and how the gods within that society got together and elected a god to represent them to bring order, and, you know, within the yin and the yang. Do you see any correlation with that with today's society and maybe kind of the backlash of what's going on against social justice warriors and the politically correct and all these other aspects of our society?
Well, I certainly, yes, I think that's a theme that's playing itself out across the Western world, and I suspect it's going to get a lot more intense before it rectifies itself. I think that people are feeling very deep in their souls that our society has become too chaotic. I mean, there's so many technological transformations as well as the sociological transformations that I think people are feeling destabilized and want, maybe it's a return to a previous order. I mean, I think you see that with Brexit, for example, is that the British population decided that they didn't trust the large-scale bureaucrats and the push towards globalization and the sort of, I would say, more radical left-wing social justice agenda that seems to go along with that. They rejected it for a return to a smaller sovereign unit. And I think partly that's a response against gigantism too. It's like maybe the European Economic Community is simply too big. It gets too distant from the people that it represents. That could easily be the case. It seems to be the case. I think that's going to happen a lot more in the upcoming years. I mean, the Netherlands is likely to pull out, and it wouldn't surprise me if France pulls out. And it looks very unstable.
Yeah, and you know, I was really moved when I saw your interview with Joe Rogan. You know, with your the way that you describe spirituality and you know your views on religion, and you know, for even if you want to be an atheist or agnostic or whatever you choose to be, I think you have to at least respect that the religion played an integral part in our society and the foundation of our society, and that there's a lot of wisdom that was passed along. And one thing that's really weird is like in the public school system, you know, here in Ontario, but pretty much in Western civilization, religion is being pulled out altogether. And it's kind of hard not to address such a big aspect of, you know, what created us. And I wonder if like, there wasn't so much wisdom within this religion that people, you know, say, well, I don't really believe in, you know, traditional religion, but then they pull away and don't really look at the fact of what some of the wisdom that's been passed down. I mean, we talked about like people getting older and not having somebody there, and there were always seemed to be a wisdom within religion of forming a family unit and keeping that together and things like that. And I have to think it's kind of arrogant for us to think we're going to completely reinvent the wheel and that everything that came before us is not useful. And I have to think there's a lot of things that generation after generation were passed down that, you know, was a map that for us to follow, you know, to have a full life. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, you say that religion has been taken out of the schools, but the funny thing is it's flooding back in, you know, because there's a void and it's being filled with this push towards radical social justice and, you know, equality of outcome, equality and diversity together, although those two things seem to be opposites to me, have become the new, you could think about it as the beginnings of a state religion. And the problem is that there's a hole in people's souls that religious structures fill. And if the structures themselves are destroyed, then other things flow in to fill that hole. And they're often ideas that are much crazier than the original ideas. So, and then things destabilize very badly. And it seems to me that that's certainly happening in our culture. I mean, the Russian thinkers like Solzhenitsyn and Dostoevsky, they were very careful analysts of the proclivity towards ideological chaos. Excuse me. The proclivity towards ideological chaos in a society. And they both believed that a return to the old forms was necessary. Solzhenitsyn felt that that was the only antidote to the kind of socialist horrors of the Soviet Union, that the culture had to return to its previous path of development. I mean, it's hard for people to sort that out. It's very difficult for people to sort that out. I mean, I think the in Christianity, you have this idea of God the Father. And the idea there is that there's a central figure who's like the spirit of culture that sets out the ordering principles. And those are fatherly principles. And then you have the idea of the Son, and the Son is the person who speaks the truth fundamentally. That's the Savior from a Christian perspective. And you know, even if you don't admit that those entities have a kind of a metaphysical existence, there are certainly principles that need to be respected. There is such a thing as the spirit of the culture, the ordering principles of the culture. There better be, because otherwise everything is just chaos. And the idea that the spoken truth is redemptive, which I think is the central idea of Christianity, I think that that's an indisputable that's as indisputable an existential guideline as you're ever likely to find. I mean, honest communication is the prerequisite for trust, and trust is the prerequisite for social order. So if people aren't speaking honestly and attempting to maintain order, then everything falls apart. And that wouldn't be good if everything fell apart.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I want to take it from kind of that macro level to the micro level, because, you know, what can we do as individuals? And that's where I think, you know, your self-authoring program can really help. And I really encourage people, and I'll link it down below on how to go to it. But I wanted to talk a bit about that, because I think that as we navigate this, even if society is changing and doing things, can still be responsible for ourselves and our own choices that we make and how we choose to define our character, as you would say. And one thing I found is that a lot of people seem to live in the past. And I've actually known a significant amount of people where, and I know it's hard, I mean, tragic events happen, but it's almost like they live in the past of whatever the last tragedy was until the next tragedy happens. And unfortunately, as you described in Maps of Meaning, you know, the world is a hard place, and this is going to be something that's going to be very challenging for children who were, you know, very kind of kept in a bubble growing up and stuff. I mean, I think this, I'm almost quoting you directly, that, you know, everybody we know will die, we will die, and our everything that we create will fail, and, you know, chances are that we won't even be remembered. You know, that's just kind of a sad thing. And I know that I've had people tell me, well, that's a negative outlook. But I mean, I think that you have to be honest and realistic in order to kind of understand how to live your life. I mean, I had a near-death experience, and I remember at that time, I have a personality where I've gone and achieved a lot of things, and I wasn't so scared about death as a result of that. But I feel that there's people that they're so traumatized by certain events that then they kind of shell up and they're afraid to take any risks whatsoever. And I know that that anxiety can be understandable and that you see that within your practice. But, you know, unless you get out there and experience life, what's going to happen when you're at the end of your life, so to speak, and you've gone just kind of from one tragedy to the other, and you've never really done anything? And when I mean done anything, I mean like take chances, you know, travel, go after your goals, do certain things. Why do you think people, you know, are so paralyzed by the past that they don't live in the moment or make plans for the future?
Well, I think sometimes it's because they haven't had any guidance, like no one's modeled for them making a plan and living in a productive manner. I think sometimes it's because they want to avoid responsibility, so they don't want to take on the burden of having to contend with the world and plot the future. And then often they're overwhelmed by things that have happened to them, and they don't have anybody to talk to in any deep sense, and they can't make sense out of the world. They can't understand why they've been betrayed or hurt or their dreams fell apart. And that's partly why some knowledge of mythology is helpful, because mythology always describes the descent into the underworld and then the reascent. And people descend into the underworld all the time when their dreams fall apart. Part of the reason that we built the self-authoring program, especially the past authoring, was to help people think through their past catastrophes so that they can let go of them. Because otherwise you can be consumed by the past, which means you never really get out of the underworld. And so sometimes people are so hurt they can't move forward. And it's partly because they don't thoroughly understand what happened to them. They can't orient themselves properly in the world, and so they have no idea how to proceed.
And I know that you, I believe it was a relative of yours that lived in, or sorry, that works in the care of people who are, you know, near the end of their life. And I knew somebody that was in that position. And one of the things that she told me was that there's a lot of people who are at that stage and that they have regret that they didn't take more chances with their life or do more things. And I mean, the sad thing is it's kind of too late at that point in time. And I've always tried to myself live my life as if from the knowledge of that, you know, seeing from that point of view, so that, you know, going through life, I try not to have regret, because I mean, I can imagine no worse thing than you suddenly think, well, I should have done this or that, and you know that you're going to pass away, and also that your body is not healthy and you can't go and do those things. And, you know, you used the expression in one of your interviews that a lot of people see what they're losing by taking risk, but they don't see what they're losing by not taking risk.
Yes, definitely. And that's always worth thinking about. I mean, it's one of the things that I advise my clients is that when they're afraid to do something, they should balance that against the fear of not doing it. Because it's easy to think that the path you're on has no cost, but it does. And inaction can often be a catastrophe. And I do think there is something too that perhaps if you live your life thoroughly, you won't regret that it comes to an end. I mean, I don't know that for sure, obviously, but it seems to me that it's an idea worth serious consideration. If you lived your life fully, then maybe you've had enough of it, and it'll be okay that it has an end.
Right. And
I don't know a better solution to the problem.
Right. And, you know, we are blessed, so to speak, that we do have a life. And I think it's very important to see that as a gift. And it kind of makes me sad in a way that we live in a society that we've got more than any other person within time has ever really been given in terms of access to information, you know, abilities to look after our health, and, you know, how comfortable we are. And, you know, you and I being in Canada, or anybody that's in the US or other Western civilization, how well they have it, you're a student of history. So you understand that within our time and within our locale, people have it better than they've ever had. And to me, to squander that is kind of an insult to all the people that came before us that fought, you know, the wars and through plagues and everything to get here, to just waste life. I mean, that's kind of...
Yeah, to squander it and to undermine it and to be resentful despite the fact that you have more opportunity and options than anybody ever has had in the history of the world.
Right. I think it's actually a responsibility of us to... Because there are so many people that paid the price for us to be here and to have that opportunity, to try at least to do as much as we can with it, and to not just be hedonistic and selfish and enjoy the pleasures, but also to give back in some way and to help people.
Well, one of the things that we do with the Future Authoring Program is ask people to think about how, if they did things properly for themselves, how that might be of benefit to their family and to the broader community. Because it seems to me that if you do things correctly, that means that it works for you now and in the medium to long run. And it also works for your family, and it also works for the community. And you have to think about all those things simultaneously when you're trying to figure out what's best. And it's necessary to strive for what's best. It is a responsibility. It's the highest responsibility, as you pointed out.
Yeah, I read a book one time, and it talked about don't have fuzzy goals. Like, have specific goals. And even if those, you know, and people will think, well, what if that goal doesn't work out? Well, you can always change your goal. But I've always used the thought in my head that if you're a boat that's just out in the ocean and you're just drifting, at least point the boat in a direction and go towards an island. And even if it's the wrong island, at least you're on a path to something instead of just sort of this.
Yes.
You know,
exactly right. Well, at least you're right. I mean, and that is what the literature shows too, is that better a faulty goal than no goal at all. Because if you pursue a faulty goal, at least you learn exactly why it was faulty. And then you're smarter, and the next goal you formulate will be more precise. I'm going to have to stop here pretty quick because I'm afraid I'm running out of voice.
I understand. Well, you know, I really appreciate your time. So I want to give you the opportunity to speak about the self-authoring program and why people should engage in it, what it'll do for them, and most importantly, how they can go about, finding it and how to follow you and learn more about you and the things that you're putting out there into the world to help people.
Well, they can watch my videos at Jordan Peterson Videos on YouTube. There's about 150 videos. Most of them are classes that I've conducted at the University of Toronto. And the self-authoring program can be found at www.selfauthoring.com, S-E-L-F-A-U-T-H-O-R-I-N-G. So authoring like writing a book, and self like yourself, selfauthoring.com. And that's where you can find the past authoring program, the two present authoring programs, and the future authoring programs. And they provide people with an opportunity to write themselves a more articulated and detailed and hopefully productive and meaningful life. And as I said, we've done a fair bit of research, especially on the future authoring program, and it, regardless of what your goals are, it'll help you commit to them and increase the probability that you'll carry out your plans. And that's a big deal because, you know, it's hard to carry out plans. You need the motivation to do it because, of course, the world objects to you carrying out your plans. But a detailed and articulated vision of who you could be is a real weapon that you can use in the world to advance yourself, and to advance yourself in a way that's beneficial not only for you but also for other people. So it's a noble goal. And I think one of the things that gives people self-respect, given that they're vulnerable and easy to despise in some sense, is to have a noble goal. It gives you strength and gives you virtue. And those are the highest goals that you can pursue. So the self-authoring program is our attempt to help people accomplish that.
Well, I highly recommend it. And people will spend a fortune to get gym memberships and to go and get makeup and all these other things to try and improve their exterior. And, you know, unfortunately, looks fade, but, you know, personalities are there forever. And I really wish that people would spend more time investing in themselves and improving themselves, because it would not only make their life a better place, but would help all of us. Because, I mean, if everybody took your program, I think we'd have a much better world. And that, I think that would be a very good thing. And, you know, I want to personally thank you. I mean, watching your material, your videos, you know, participating in everything that you do, I've learned a lot, and it's very much helped me. And I know that you don't have to do that stuff. So I think it is virtuous of you to put that stuff out in the universe for people to see. And I think you're one of the, if not one of the great thinkers of our time, at least one of the great articulators of our time, in terms of taking all of this knowledge and putting it together in a way that people can pretty easily understand. And I think that's a tremendous value. And I'm glad that, you know, in today's technology, that it's not just the people within your classroom that can benefit from that. And I'm pretty shocked at the number of views that you get for lectures.
Yeah.
I mean, these aren't cat, you know, falling off
They're
a roof.
They're not cute cat videos. No, it's amazing. It's amazing, I think. And it's very gratifying to work on YouTube, because I know that the people that I'm reaching are only watching because they want to know.
Yeah, I mean, I sat there and I watched every one of your lectures. And And I enjoyed at least 90% of it. I was engaged in it. I mean, there, you're a great storyteller in the way that you articulate things, and you don't waste time with the things that you talk about. So I'm very impressed, and I'm not trying to, you know, give you some kind of like false compliments. I mean, I'm a big believer in you and a supporter in you, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, is to be able to help you and to extend your reach, whatever I can do in that regard to reach more people. So,
well, it's much appreciated, and I thank you very much for the conversation and for the opportunity.
Well, thank you. Guys, I'll post all the links below to Jordan B. Peterson's YouTube, to his social media, and to the self-authoring program. I encourage you to purchase it. I think, is it $14.99, something like that, for the one? Can you break down what the cost?
I think the future authoring program is on sale right now. I think it's $9.95, and you can buy all three for $29.90, and then you get a license for a friend as well.
Yeah. And hey, it's the Christmas season. It's a great gift. What greater gift can you give than to, you know, help people within their life? I mean, it's truly underestimated at this point in time. And I mean, the cost to go see a therapist and stuff like that is pretty expensive at this point in time. So if people can even work on themselves, and hey, the knowledge is out there now, people can, you know, I feel like I at least got a C+ in your class just by taking your lectures. So
excellent.
All right. Well, thanks, Jordan. I really appreciate your time and everything.
No problem. It was really good meeting you.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.